I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast.
Hey, everyone. Sam speaking. It's already that time of year again for CPA, and for the first time in several years, we're going to be doing it in person. A lot of us are going to be traveling over the next few days. Many of us will be at the conference on Thursday. And in order to get everyone a little bit hyped, we've recorded a few 5 to 10 minute recordings with some of the up-and-coming stars in our division. These individuals have earned awards for their work at CPA 2022 this year. And they will be going into more depth at the poster sessions or during their talks. So please go find them, talk to them, hear them out. But hopefully this little sample of what will be at CPA will get everyone excited and will encourage people who aren't going this year to attend next year. For now, just sit back, enjoy the flight, if you're on your flight to CPA, and enjoy the talks by these rising stars. Our first guest on the show is Dr. Javon Rice. Dr. Rice is a postdoctoral fellow at UC Berkeley, and her talk at CPA is titled "Training in Substance Use Disorders Among Black American Emerging Adults for Psychologists." Welcome to the episode, Dr. Rice.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here and talk about this. This is my vibe.
Very excited to hear about what you have to say in this talk. So if you want to, you can go ahead and tell us what it's all about.
Yeah. So this is actually a study that I have been working on for the past, actually before I even started my doctorate program. So what this study really is focused on is exploring, you know, how we engage a psychologist in our training programs around substance use training, specifically in the area of like a multicultural or a culture first aspect. So being a culturally aware, but we're specifically looking at Black American emerging adults with substance use. So when you look at the accreditation requirements or even licensure requirements, so that's two aspects, right? The accreditation requirements for doctoral programs to become psychologists through APA. Then we're also looking at the licensure requirements to become a psychologist in the United States, including DC. And among all of those, only California is a state that requires a substance use training of some sort in order to become a psychologist. And no requirement among APA accreditation for any of the clinical programs to have substance use. Wow. Now, this was astounding for me. And even when looking at these requirements, there's nothing specific around the multicultural component for substance use classes, right? So not only when you go through all the states, could you be a graduating and actively practicing psychologist who has never had a course on substance use, let alone one that specifically incorporated multicultural in the Black American emerging adult. Because when we're talking about this cultural aspect, it's an intersectionality, right? So we're not just talking about Black Americans. We're not just talking about emerging adults, which are two aspects of substance use research that are significantly lacking. Mm. We're also talking about the training of psychologists within that program. And so what my study found was, A, I created an original measure that specifically incorporated knowledge-based section, specifically asking questions, multiple choices around using different vignettes and type of clients that you might have, specifically Black American emerging adults. But it also included a section around comfort and their awareness of comfort when working with this population, or comfort when working with substance use on its own, and that aspect, as well as a section that specifically talked about their program. And so it's not just the curriculum aspect, but also their training, their clinical training sites, right? Because in order to graduate from an APA accredited program, you have to complete certain training sites and internships, right? So all of this aspect we're looking at. And when doing this, what we ended up finding was that there is a different types of impact on the comfort level. And although the knowledge might be present, the level of comfort was impacted around their training. And so now we're looking at, not only was training impacting comfort level, right? But that the student or trainee, because this was only people that were unlicensed could participate in this measure.
Right.
Not only was that those folks did not had the knowledge, but did not feel confident in their knowledge, right? So now we have folks that are knowledgeable somehow, and yet are maybe missing a lot of their aspects in regards to the support we're providing for these communities, right? Mm. Because if we are not comfortable in it, we do not ask it. And a lot of the research that I did find showing up was on that, is that if we are, as psychologists and training program, are not comfortable with certain aspects, the higher our comfort level comes, the more likely we are to engage with that, right? Now, what we didn't see coming, and I say we, it's just me. I'm the only one that did it. So it's the royal we. So what I didn't see coming was the fact that there were two types of training impacts. So people were responding towards their training that they got with through their coursework and the training they got through their clinical practice. So your practicums, your internships, your postdocs. And there was a difference. And what the next step will be is, where does that difference go? What do we see with this? Because there's clearly an impact, right? So what's next? And so that's what this study kind of looks at, is just kind of reviewing how can we utilize this information to actually better support psychologists, the way we support in this country, mental health counselors. So master's level, they have the requirement for substance use training and coursework. MDs, they also have a requirement of either substance use or some form of mental health. And so that's a requirement for things. And they even have to stay updated on it. Social workers and psychologists, not necessarily required. And even psychologists, only required for California. Hmm. So how many psychologists do we have out there that are practicing within a community that may be missed? And then we have this idea that because we are working in we only see substance use disorders within certain sites, is what we like to say, like, oh, community mental health. Hmm. Oh, if I'm working in this, I'm working in early development, then I don't have to worry about that. What we don't think about is that Black American emerging adults come in through services in multiple avenues, and they tend not to come directly through substance use, but through the other aspects that are impacting their life due to the substance use. Hmm. So we're talking, so there is a very good chance you would see a Black American emerging adult with a child in early development with a substance use disorder. And because we're looking at it for the child and not necessarily the emerging adult who could be their parent, we miss it. Hmm. So what would happen if we change that? And so This is the first step of kind of exploring that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it's a very underserved population in general in our field, underrepresented also among providers as well. This is really interesting to hear about, and I'm really excited to hear the full talk and to get all of the information about these different impacts. But could you tell us a little bit, just I have one question real quick. How do you see this work being used to sort of guide the future of our field? Psychology.
Oh, I am so excited you asked that question. So here's what this is the goal, right? This is an original measure. It does not exist, period. There was one being done with Dr. Jessica Martin up in, SUNY Albany. But it wasn't specific around the cultural aspect, right? And then multiple identities. But the goal for this would be to continue to enhance the validity and reliability of the measure, so that we can start to utilize it when we're creating our programs, right? So that's how I see this, so that you could create an elevation of the programs we already have. We already have the abilities to put the aspect of a culture first training program in sight that also includes substance use as a mental health disorder and not separate. which is what we consistently keep doing despite the research that says it's the same. It is not substance use and mental health, it's substance use and other. And so if we were to actually train our psychologists the way that we are asking to be trained historically, then I think this measure could be beautiful, because then training programs could utilize this when they're doing their competencies. Mm. Yeah. And they, whether or not it's a pass or no pass, but just the idea that you could still use it for the, to enhance your program. Also help your students.
Yeah, absolutely. And help the people we're trying to serve. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much for going over that, Dr. Rice. Excited to hear your talk.
You're welcome. Can't wait.
Next on the show, we have Victoria Chintsova, who is a first-year experimental psychology master's student at William & Mary, who will be applying to clinical psychology PhD programs in the next round for anybody who's listening. Her poster is entitled Internalizing Symptoms, Rumination, and Problematic Social Network Site Use Across National Examination. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here today.
We're really excited to have you on. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your work?
Yeah. So this research was really exciting to me, as it was one of my first experiences I had working with cross-national data. It was also a really good transition from some of my undergrad research interest with social media and my current career interest with addiction and harm reduction. So I'm sure, as you all know, daily engagement with social media sites is increasing globally, and identifying and understanding the risk factors associated with problematic engagement, or engagement that's conducive to addictive behaviors or maladaptive use with these sites, is really important. Just looking through some of the literature now, we see that researchers are interested in understanding internalizing symptoms like depression and social anxiety as both risk factors for, as well as negative consequences of, problematic social networking site use, which certainly complicates the research a little bit. But some of this existing research has proposed rumination alongside those internalizing symptoms as an associated risk factor. Unfortunately, there isn't a ton of research on that, and there's even less research on that cross-culturally. So the purpose of our study was to examine those gaps in the literature and see whether rumination as a whole, as well as the various subfacets of rumination, which includes problem-focused thoughts, counterfactual thoughts, repetitive thoughts, and anticipatory thoughts, equally influence the relationship between internalizing symptoms and social networking site use outcomes, that being things like hours of use and problematic use symptoms. Of course, in addition to that, we wanted to see if those effects are stable across different cultures. And so to explore that, we leveraged data from a larger cross-sectional study that collected information from colleges and universities across 7 different countries all across the globe. So that includes the US, Canada, Argentina, Uruguay, South Africa, Spain, and England. And so all of our participants from all those countries filled out a survey that asked questions regarding internalizing symptoms, rumination, weekly social networking site use, and problematic social networking site use. And so ultimately, our analyses revealed a few different quite interesting things. For one thing, we confirmed that internalizing symptoms and rumination are both positively associated with problematic social networking site use, as well as time spent online, which basically means that for folks who exhibit higher symptoms of depression or social anxiety, it's likely that we'll see them engaging in more problematic engagement with those sites and for longer periods of time. We found, however, that the association was much stronger with problematic use rather than hours of use. So though we found that there were significant associations between internalizing symptoms and rumination with hours of use, they were very weak associations. And certainly the star of the show when it came to this research was associations with problematic site use. I feel like that kind of sounds surprising generally, but given the existing research on this, there is quite a bit of research that shows that increased hours spent on these sites isn't necessarily conducive to using those sites problematically. And so I think kind of on the street, this would sound surprising, but given a lot of the existing literature, this actually made quite a bit of sense. And then just getting more into the specific subtypes of rumination, we did find that not all of the subtypes of rumination were equally relevant in the model. And so we found that problem-focused thoughts had the most relevance in this model, where it accounted for something like a fourth of the total association between internalizing symptoms and problematic social networking site use. So I know that was a mouthful, but maybe one of the biggest wins of the research and probably the finding I want to highlight the most is that our multi-group models revealed that the associations were similar across countries. Hmm. So for this model of rumination mediating the relationship between internalizing symptoms and the problematic use, things seem to be similar across the various different countries, which again, kind of surprising given that we see that different people in different countries are using social media differently. There's different popularity of different sites. But at the same time, maybe it reveals something a little bit more about the way that people are engaging sites generally across the globe. So overall, I'd say that our findings provide some pretty good support for further exploring the role rumination plays in determining and comparing social networking site use outcomes cross-culturally or cross-nationally. I do want to say, though, given that our data was cross-sectional, we can't make conclusions about causality or directions other than those that, of course, are supported by theory. And so ideally, we would conduct some longitudinal or experimental work to follow this up to help determine directionality a little bit more clearly. And in fact, we just started conducting a follow-up study to this that is longitudinal. So stay tuned for any follow-up results that we may have.
Wow, that's so awesome. That usually my question is, what would be the next steps? But you're already in the middle
of it. We're there. Yeah, so, we're right there.
I'd love to hear a little bit, if you had, if you wouldn't mind, a little bit about how you got interested in this. This is such an interesting area.
Yeah, that is a great question. And I think that's especially a great question because my areas of research interest right now are much more focused on the substance use space. And so behaviors like social media use is kind of outside of the scope of what I generally do. That being said, variety in research never hurts, especially for someone young in their career. I feel like there's a lot that I'm passionate about and excited about. And I did dabble in some social networking site research as an undergrad. It was mostly around stigma and how sites impact self-esteem, but related to what we're doing now. But I think more importantly, we pursued this research because there seems to be a lot to learn and share between research on these different types of problematic behaviors and addictive behaviors or precursors to addictive behaviors. It's really interesting because the idea of rumination playing a role here actually came from research we read and conducted on rumination playing a role in mediating the relationship between internalizing symptoms and problematic substance use. So we took this model directly from the substance use space and applied it to a different potentially problematic behavior. And I think, again, as a young researcher, it's really important for me to sort of diversify the theory and the approaches to theory I'm exposed to, because it can really inform my research or hopefully inspire some new perspectives or just maybe provide insight that could be really important for moving the field forward. Fingers crossed if my career goes according to plan. So yeah, there's a lot of parallels between problematic social networking site use and substance use. And I don't want to minimize the fact that they are unique and they are distinct. But at the same time, there are lessons that we can learn from research in either that could really inspire some great progress in the other.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much. That was such a cool project that you discussed with us. And thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me today. Really appreciate it.
All right, next up, we have Peter Soyster, doctoral candidate in clinical science at UC Berkeley. And he is going to be giving us a talk, giving a talk at CPA and then discussing it on our episode right now on personalized machine learning models to predict future alcohol use. Welcome, Peter.
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
We are so glad you're here. You want to walk us through your study?
Yeah, so I can certainly give kind of a brief overview, and if you have questions, I'll have you chat about that. So I'm a relative newcomer to substance use research. I'm still a doctoral candidate and haven't kind of gone on to bigger and, greater things yet. But I've always been struck by the fact that what I read about in research, when we talk about kind of like how, if I can just allow myself one little bit of stigmatizing language, how like drug addicts are, right? How like drug users are. I've always been really struck that that's just ignoring a huge amount of variability in every other human behavior that I've ever witnessed. And so as I've come into grad school and kind of come into this field, I've always been kind of struck by this tension, right? About kind of, I'm using my finger quotes here. Sorry for the folks on the on the podcast, but like the kind of mean level. I hope my voice gave the finger quotes there. The kind of like mean level experience, right, that we all learned in psych and stats 101, with the intense variability that exists in human behavior and human experience. And so, there's this interesting tension where folks, I think before we learn anything about stats, we have this belief that like folks are pretty different, right? I've taught undergrad stats a lot and kind of convincing folks that like the mean is a good guess for the group is a little bit of a hard sell for folks that haven't been kind of brought into that way of thinking. But I think for folks on the other end of the spectrum, right? Psychologists, folks who've been here for a long time, what they've forgotten is that the mean is an excellent guess. It's the best guess you can make in the absence of additional information. If you don't have anything else to go on, then the mean is the best guess. However, we live in a world where we can get all sorts of extra information. And so there's this kind of interesting way that we can start to move forward to say, let's not pretend these kind of group level mean inferences aren't important. They're certainly important. The reason that the three people on this call haven't died from polio is because of kind of group level nomothetic inference, right? Let's not pretend that's not important. It can be super important. And it can also maybe not tell us some things that some other areas of inference perhaps could. And so the way that I've been kind of diving into the substance use research field is to see what are the things that we can get from this group level inference? What have we kind of already gotten? And I would be happy to chat with anybody who would disagree with me on this point, but we certainly haven't like, quote unquote, solved addiction, right? The best minds in our field have been working for so long. And at least to my reading literature, we have hit a little bit of a ceiling. And so to me, that kind of invites new ideas, new methods, new avenues for trying to look at old problems. So this study that I'm presenting is really all about trying to kind of start to look at if we move past that mean inference level of analysis, can we get additional information from individuals that might really help us better understand what's gonna drive their substance use? So, this was a study with all humility, 33 undergraduates, right? This isn't exactly, science level sample. And I think what we did with these data were a bit kind of maybe different from how folks tend to use this sort of data. Data is plural. So we had 33 undergraduates who filled out an EMA survey of alcohol use 8 times a day for 15 days. They reported, in addition to you know, kind of since the last survey, did you use any alcohol? And if so, how much? And they talked about all sorts of things that, like, really excellent psychological theory suggests should predict alcohol use, momentary alcohol use. I think that's an important distinction that we're talking about, not kind of what is the distinguishing factors between somebody who develops an alcohol use disorder and who doesn't, but we're talking about, for somebody who uses alcohol at least sometimes, what's the differentiating factors between the moments they choose to use and the moments they choose not to use. We invoke things like expectancies, the extent to which folks were interested in using, how much they intended to use. And then we had a whole bunch of emotional behavioral items, like, how are you feeling right now? Who are you with right now? You know, for us, I say us because Aaron Fisher, my mentor, has just been unbelievably helpful and supportive in this work. And part of that is that he's kind of let me kind of feel out how I'm feeling about this, which is that, you know, I really kind of conceptualize substance use as this intensive combination between internal and external context. So the internal context is just everything that happens underneath the skin, right? Everything that you think, feel, do, believe, kind of everything inside that. And the external context is amazingly important things that we know about, right? Context, time, location, you know, society, these kind of broader structures. Everything here is interaction between these two. And so the real focus of the work is trying to be able to create predictive models. Can we understand when someone is going to use a substance on an individual level? The final thing I'll say, because I'm looking at the time and I think I may already be pushing the limits of that, is that people are different, right? Any clinician will tell you that, right? Any preschooler will tell you that. And also, what we know is that people are not always different all of the time. They can sometimes be uniquely similar. And so what this work was really about was trying to understand the predictive validity of conceptualizing folks' momentary substance use as completely different and completely similar, and trying to understand kind of where, do we get a greater predictive signal from conceptualizing substance use as a between subjects process, right? That whatever's going to cause participant A to drink in this case is going to be the same process that's going to cause participant B to drink, with some individual differences. Or do we really think about substance use as an individualistic process, where the kind of individual motivations are completely different and borrowing information between folks is not particularly helpful?
That's very interesting, Peter. And I think that this, it's a lot to process in a pretty short amount of time, even in the full talk, it will be, because it's a paradigm shift, in a lot of ways. And, I really appreciate you walking me through this. And just a quick question, I'm wondering where you see this research taking you, given this sort of big shift, what do you expect to do next with this?
Yeah. It's a great question. And I think, I'd like to clarify that, this kind of ideography, this person-specific approach that a lot of my research takes, it's based on a different set of assumptions than kind of a lot of psychological research, but it's still an assumption, right? In the same way that, kind of nomothetic between persons research has the assumption that if we can borrow information between people, we're going to get a better sense of what's true for the group and gain insights from that. The kind of ideography has the assumption that we can't really do that and are going to maybe try to move towards just really identifying, you know, and analyzing one person's data at a time. So the future of this work, I mean, at least for me, is completely related to the results of what I'm doing now. I'm a little bit of a bleeding heart, right? So for me, it's like I'm not tied to a method. I'm really tied to just trying to reduce the suffering of folks who suffer with substance use disorders or whatever the current nomenclature is. I've been convinced that Idiography is maybe a way to help kind of push that ball a little bit forward. To answer more concretely, my dissertation work is completely about trying to, kind of move this ball forward, involve stakeholders, so like current substance users, in the design of different EMA studies, and really trying to see, you know, to what degree can we kind of, I'll put it this way, I'm pretty proud of this paper. It's pretty amazing that even in out-of-sample testing, we were able to predict with 76% accuracy to 78% accuracy when someone was going to use several hours before they did. I'm really into that. And also, that's a little bit kind of academic, if you'll forgive the term, if that's not ultimately able to be kind of parlayed into supporting recovery for folks who are interested in changing their substance behavior, and a lot of folks aren't. But for the folks that are, I'm really interested in kind of developing tools to help move them in that direction.
Yeah, a little bit of evidence to be built and a little bit of translation to be had. So,
fingers crossed.
Yeah, thank you so much, Peter. That was fascinating. Looking forward to seeing your talk at CPA in Portland.
Cool, thank you.
Next on the show, we have Madison Smith. Madison is a first-year clinical psychology PhD student at East Tennessee State University. Her poster is titled, "Which Types of Substance-Related Legal Problems Are Most Predictive of Arrest?" Madison, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
We're really excited to hear what you have to talk about, so why don't you tell us a little bit about your poster?
Yeah, sure. So the main goal of our poster was to try to figure out which substance-related legal problems are most predictive of arrest. So we know that substance use is prevalent among people involved in the criminal justice system. And based on statistics that the Department of Justice put out last year, an average of 28% of individuals incarcerated reporting drinking alcohol at the time of their arrest, and an average of 35% of individuals reported being intoxicated with drugs at the time of their arrest. So we also know that substance use disorders are very prevalent, with an average of about 40% of individuals incarcerated meeting criteria for the disorder. There's also some preliminary evidence that alcohol, marijuana, and stimulant use put individuals at risk for drug-related legal problems. However, research examining how those substance-related legal problems differentially relate to arrests have not been previously examined. So our study tried to kind of fill this gap and address some of this information that isn't out there already in the literature. So to do this, we drew on a sample of adults that participated in the National Survey of Drug Use and Health. And we examined questions related to legal problems due to varying substances and also the number of times that they had been arrested in the past 12 months. Overall, we found that although substance-related legal problems vary greatly between the different substances, they are overall a major driver of arrest in the U.S., and alcohol-related legal problems are found to be the strongest predictor of arrest. So that means that alcohol use uniquely increases the risk of arrest over some of the other substances that also can be at risk for arrest. So we believe that alcohol use should be a focus for prevention and intervention efforts in community populations and something that needs to be researched more in order for us to truly understand some of these links and to get down to help people in the community with their alcohol use disorder and hopefully prevent them from being arrested in the future.
Awesome. What really cool work. So as you might imagine, this has some clinical implications, I'm sure. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about those.
Yeah. So considering the high rates of arrest among people with alcohol-related legal problems, it's pretty important that we develop interventions that target alcohol use in order to help assist with prevention. So some of the things that I think would be important next steps are increased screening that allow for more early testing and screening for problematic alcohol use. And I think this could possibly be best implemented in an integrated care model. So my program does a lot of integrated primary care work, and I think this is a great place that we could implement some of this stuff. A lot of people who are involved in the criminal justice system have high rates of healthcare utilization, especially people with substance use disorders. So I think that that is a good place to start. That way we could get some of that screening. And if we were able to catch people earlier, we might be able to do some psychoeducation regarding drinking and driving and kind of teach people about this high risk of incarceration whenever they do participate in problematic drinking and some of those criminal behaviors that might lead to arrest.
Awesome. Well, I think that has a lot of potential for us to really make some key differences in the communities that we work with. So thank you so much for coming on the show, and thank you so much for talking to us about this area.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right. For the next guest, we have Melissa Schick, who is a longtime listener and returning guest. Actually, go listen to her previous episode if you haven't already. Melissa is a sixth-year clinical psychology PhD student at the University of Rhode Island. She's wrapping up her predoctoral clinical psychology internship at the Charleston Consortium in South Carolina, and her poster is called Gender Parity and Homophily in the Drug and Alcohol Dependence Editorial Process. Welcome, Melissa. We're happy to have you. How's it going?
Thanks for having me. I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Doing great. Just enjoying talking to all these wonderful up and coming stars in our field. So can you walk us through your project?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is perhaps not the most organized way to go through it, but this is what I've got for you. So this project really came out of my research preceptor on internship, Rachel Tomko's experience as an editorial fellow at Drug and Alcohol Dependence. She had kind of this observation that as an editorial fellow, your decisions and review invitations and things like that go out under the name of different associate editors. And she kind of had this observation that she would get different responses based on whether the invitations were going out from a male or a man versus a female or a woman handling editor or associate editor. And that led her to kind of wonder, you know, whether there might be kind of something going on there where the gender of the editor is making some kind of difference in the way people are responding to review invitations. Or whether it might be something else kind of going on altogether. So she originally had this idea for this project as an editorial fellow. And then when I came on for internship, I ended up being lucky enough to get involved in this project. So really what we were able to do is we were able to get editorial data for drug and alcohol dependence from all of the paper submissions from 2004 to 2019, wow. We were able to get the number of reviewers who were invited, whether the reviewers accepted or rejected invitations. And then Elsevier, which is the publisher of Drug and Alcohol Dependence, has this like algorithm. I don't really know the computer science part of it, but that's able to, based on the first and last name and country of origin of the person, infer a gender of that person. So we also have an inferred gender for each editor and invited reviewer for each of these manuscript submissions. So what we wanted to see was whether there were gender differences and who was being invited to review. Gender differences in who is accepting invitations to review, and then whether there was evidence of homophily. So homophily is really just a preference for people who are like you. So we were curious to see if men would be more likely to accept review invitations from men editors, and women would be more likely to accept review invitations from women. And what we found, which is, I think, really interesting, were kind of three main points. So first, we really didn't find a gender difference in who was being invited to serve as reviewers. Men and women editors were approximately equally likely to invite men and women to serve as reviewers. So that's kind of the first piece that we found. The second piece is that overall, the likelihood of accepting review invitations has really dropped over time. Dropped from around 75% of review invitations being accepted to only about 50% of review invitations being accepted. And what we found is that over time, women have been less likely to review, and men have stayed pretty consistent over time. Then the final thing we found was some evidence of homophily on the part of the reviewers. So in some years, not all, there was some evidence of men being more likely to accept review invitations from men and women being more likely to accept review invitations from women. So those were kind of our three big main findings.
That is really interesting. Definitely a different sort of research than I feel like I'm even used to hearing about, but critically important for so many reasons. You know, one important reason is just because these are the sort of the gatekeepers in some way of our field and the research that we read and we hear about. And so to understand this process, I think is critically important. So, I mean, you have some pretty clear findings. I wonder if you have any like recommendations for journals or for other organizations on how to use these findings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think these findings have actually really important kind of recommendations that stem from them pretty naturally. I think you're right. I think this is really important, and it's also not research that I'm used to doing. But like you said, really, peer review serves as kind of the gate through which science passes, right? So if we're thinking about who's responsible for what science is getting through, it's really actually important that we have a diverse array of folks considering, you know, what research should pass through. And before I actually chime on recommendations, I do think that that's an important point, is that a limitation of this project for sure is A, that we're only able to look at gender, even though we know that there's other, you know, important pieces of getting diverse viewpoints kind of with a voice at the table, but also that the algorithm that Elsevier uses is only able to assign inferred gender of men and women. And we know that gender is not actually a binary construct, but you asked for a recommendation. So I think there's a couple things. One is, I think that, you know, we found in this set of manuscript submissions that there was not evidence of homophily on the part of the editors. But I think it's something that we need to be really kind of keeping a watchful eye on, because we know that, you know, trends can change over time. And I think part of that is that, you know, when I fill out a registration form to register as an author or reviewer or whatever, a lot of times they ask that information. They ask, you know, really, they usually ask about sex because they're asking about male or female, but they ask about race and they ask about, you know, certain things like that. And something that could probably actually be pretty easy would be to have some kind of dashboard where editors could see, who have I invited to review? Like, what is my reviewer pool that I'm dipping into look like? Just to kind of support people having their own awareness. Or if, you know, editorial management softwares aren't currently collecting that, it's really important to collect right. So that kind of, you know, we can be aware of that. I also think at an individual level, there's a couple things. One is that I think, you know, when we are getting review invitations, there's something to be said for suggesting other reviewers versus just like rejecting one, which, you know, we all have to reject them sometimes, right? Like there's been such a proliferation in journals and in submissions that, you know, we think that that's probably why the rate of accepting reviews has gone down. It's because there's just so much that needs to be reviewed. But I think that this can be a really good opportunity to be kind of like spreading the wealth, right? And being mindful of who you're suggesting as an alternative reviewer and who is kind of getting those opportunities, because we know that participating in the peer review process opens up a lot of opportunities in terms of networking, but also just like, you know, I feel like my writing has improved by being a reviewer in a lot of ways. So I think that's another kind of important piece at the individual level. And then I also just think I would be curious to see other journals do similar analyses.
Yeah.
You know, we really just focused on drug and alcohol dependence because it's the data we had. But it would be curious to see if this is a journal specific kind of pattern of findings, yeah. If it's, you know, there's something about substance use researchers that this would generalize to, or, you know, the field as a whole. I don't know. So it would also be really cool to just see other journals do similar analyses.
Yeah, it's great that drug and alcohol dependence collects the data and then allowed for you to use it so that you could actually look at these things. And I also love your point about essentially personalized feedback for editors and maybe reviewers too, which we all know is pretty effective in changing behaviors. Thank you so much, Melissa.
Yeah. Oh. One thing I'll note really quickly, actually, sorry, that I should have noted earlier, is that this actually, the gender that we're using isn't actually based on something that drug and alcohol dependence has collected. This is an inferred gender based on first and last name and country of origin, which I actually also think is important, because if I get an email, right, from an editor saying, hey, can you do this review? I might make some assumptions about that person based on the name that I read. So that's why in part, we use this inferred gender, but I do also think that's just something I should have noted.
Yeah.
Already, but sorry, I interrupted you.
No, interesting point. And I think that is important consideration, and love that you tied it back to the fact that you might be inferring gender as well as a reviewer or as an editor. So, well, thank you so much, Melissa. This is great. And I hope if anyone's at CPA, go check out her awesome poster.
Yeah, I'll see you there.